This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The subject we're about to discuss makes a lot of people uncomfortable. They don't want to talk about it in public, and they even have trouble talking about it in the family. No, it's not sex. It's money. Families and money. My guest, Marcia Millman, is the author of a new book on the subject called Warm Hearts and Cold Cash. It's about the emotional issues that underlie how money is divided up in the family between husbands and wives and parents and children. Millman chairs the sociology department at the University of California at Santa Cruz. Her previous books are about the backrooms of medicine and being fat in America. Why do so many people find it so difficult to talk about money with the people they're most intimately connected to?
Family money has all these emotional overtones. It has all these symbolic meanings. That money in the family, although we define love in the family as being above financial consideration, in fact, I think money is love in the family. And people use money as a sign of how much they're loved or cared about. And the other thing is that money brings up all these subjects that people like to sweep under the rug, like the fact that there's competition in the family, or that people have competing interests, or that people are concerned about their sort of private concerns, that everyone doesn't have the same values. That money just brings up a whole slew of issues that we don't like to acknowledge about family life.
I think that family money issues are changing as the economy changes and as class definitions change. For instance, as you point out in your book, this is really the first generation of middle-class men and women with significant money to pass down to the next generation. And you say, this is a kind of startling statistic, that 1 in 10 baby boomers will inherit at least $400,000.
Yeah, no one knows exactly how much they'll inherit because it depends on what will happen to the economy in the next few years. But I think this is the first generation where there is a significant transfer of wealth from middle-class parents to their children. It used to be that the major legacy in middle-class families was a kind of cultural capital, the education and the social skills that would allow children to have a middle-class life. But because the economy has changed, this is the first generation of young adults that probably won't have the same standard of living as their parents. And it's changing their relationship to their parents because for the first time, I think that children are really dependent on the money that their old parents have. And it puts them in a more dependent relationship to their parents, and it also puts them in a more competitive relationship to their siblings. I think what's happening now is a kind of shock to many middle-class families because it's really embarrassing, but for the first time, we have all these young adults who are going back to their parents for money. And the parents really don't know what to do about it. It's kind of unprecedented. The upper class has always had rules and conventions for how to pass on money from parents to children. But the middle class has to face this for the first time.
But as you point out, the upper class has had a system for passing down money, and the middle class doesn't because it's so new to them. So what are some of the new issues that this is raising for the middle class?
Well, one of the issues is whether to support adult children, whether adult children have a right to, get help with a down payment for the house or, startup funds for a business. You know, it used to be that parents fulfilled their obligation to their children when they sent them through college or maybe graduate school. But now adult children are coming back to them for all kinds of sums. So that's one issue. The second issue is the fact that there are such inequalities among siblings in their financial fates. One of the interesting things is that we assume that people who grow up in the same family will wind up with a similar lifestyle or similar social class. But in fact, siblings wind up being almost as unequal in the amount of money that they have as people who you would pick at random in the population. So I think parents are facing the fact that their children have very different financial situations, and the parents don't know what to do about distributing money among children who have such different needs.
In other words, should they compensate and give somebody who has less more, or should they just treat everybody equally?
Yes, I think that's a big dilemma for a lot of parents.
We're just joining us. My guest is sociologist Marcia Millman, and we're discussing the subject of her new book. It's about families and money, and it's called Warm Hearts, Cold Cash. Do you find that it's very difficult for aging parents and their adult children to talk about the issues of inheritance, to talk about it because it means discussing the mortality of the parents?
Yes, I do. I think that's the hardest thing. It's almost impossible to, to talk about the death that everyone knows, you know, must come. I think children have a very hard time bringing up the subject because it makes them look so greedy. Parents have a hard time because they don't want to face, you know, the reality of the death. And also, they don't want to bring up all of the issues of rivalry and competition. I think that this is something that we have a lot of problems with, that, you know, anyone who's spent any time around young children knows how passionate those rivalries are in the family. Almost all of my middle-aged friends attribute the problems of their adulthood to where they stacked up next to siblings when they were children, you know, to the situation that existed 30 years before. I think that these sibling rivalries are very, very powerful, and that parents don't want to stir up these old issues by bringing up the subject of money. You know, I think many of them would like to ask their children, well, you have less money than your, you have more money than your sister. How would you feel if I left less to you and more to your sister? They're really afraid to bring up the subject because they just don't want to stir up the old feelings. And that's one of the problems.
Have you found that there are a lot of siblings who are ending up in court contesting wills?
Oh, I don't think there are many. I think that's unusual. But I do think that there are many siblings who feel resentful. I know a lot of people who resent, for example, a sibling who keeps asking a parent for money. And, you know, they would never say anything about it, but it bothers them because, of course, it's reducing the reservoir that's supposed to be available for all, and they feel embarrassed about their feelings.
No, I think this is true, that the upper class tended to always marry the upper class, so there was both people of privilege marrying into each other's families. Now, in middle-class marriages, it's often the situation that one person has or will come into an inheritance and the other person doesn't and won't. Mm-hmm. What kind of new issues do you think that's raising in middle-class marriages?
You know, that's a really interesting issue because it brings up the whole problem of who money belongs to. You know, on the one hand, we have this ideology that everything in the family is supposed to be shared and that nobody is counting. But privately, I think people have a sense of what money is theirs, so that it belongs to them more than it does to, say, a partner. And I think certainly inherited money is often viewed as something that isn't quite, that belongs more to oneself rather than to the family as a whole. And that's a really touchy subject between spouses.
We've been talking about inheritances, but I'd like to ask you just about salaries. And, you know, it used to be in most couples that the husband was the breadwinner and the woman didn't work, so there was only one income. And now in most couples, both members are bringing in an income. So there's the question of how to divide it. Is it all pooled? Does each person maintain their own income and use that? Is it pooled 50-50, but then everybody has their own budget within that? What are some of the ways you've seen people work that out, and what reasons have they had for trying it that way?
Well, I think for people who, you know, kind of stress merging and sharing everything, who don't place that great a value on independence, I think they're more comfortable pooling all the money. Although privately, I think they're counting. That's one of the things that goes on that people don't acknowledge. I think that people who value autonomy keep separate checkbooks. Most of the professional people I know, most of the professional women I know, prefer to keep their money separate because they don't want to have to argue with their husbands every time they want to spend money in a certain way. I think, you know, one of the myths of the family and of marriage is that people have the same values and that they do want to spend their money the same way. And I think that it's not true. And One of the advantages of keeping your money separate is that you can do what you want with it without having to consult the other person all the time. But, you know, that doesn't sort of match our mythology about what family life or love is all about. So some people find that offensive or difficult to handle.
Now, let me ask you, the couples who have their own separate accounts and don't pool their money, are they often embarrassed about bringing that up with other people?
Well, the ones that I know are fairly brazen about it. You know, they take, in many cases, they take a kind of feminist attitude about it. They see that in many ways, being financially dependent has been the downfall of women, and that they want to be explicit about it. They don't think that there's anything shameful about it. But they do take a lot of ribbing from friends, or often friends say to them, you know, what kind of marriage is this where you have children together but you don't share the funds? And so it's hard. You know, it goes against the grain in many cases. You know, one couple that I wrote about was very careful about dividing funds. And in this case, the husband had come into some family money, and the wife, in order to keep up with him and in order to be able to have equal equity in the house, had to work over the summer when she was 9 months pregnant, and it was really hot, and she was dragging herself around exhausted. And her friend said to her, "Are you crazy? You're working, you know, when you're 9 months pregnant to pay back your husband?" But she felt that unless she did this, he would have more power over her. And, you know, it's one of the things that we don't like to talk about, that in the family, people exercise power, and money is one of the ways that we're able to do this. And I really respect and admire the people who are able to put this out on the table and deal with it explicitly.
If you're just joining us, my guest is sociologist Marcia Millman, and her new book is called Warm Hearts and Cold Cash: The Intimate Dynamics of Families and Money. We'll take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about families and money, and my guest is sociologist Marcia Millman. Prenuptial agreements, I think, have become increasingly popular, and I guess they're seen in a way as a technique to ward off ugly fights over money if there's a divorce. Mm-hmm. But it means settling these things before you're even married. Give us a sense of some of the prenuptial agreements you've seen, the types of arrangements people make before they're even married.
Well, you know, I actually haven't seen any of these arrangements.
You haven't?
I've heard people talk about them. I've heard, you know, talked to a few people who've done them. Many people have talked about them, and many of them wind up not signing the things. I think they are becoming more common, especially as families get more complicated, as people bring in children from previous marriages, as they've had second marriages. You know, some of the things that some people argue that it's a bad idea to have a prenuptial agreement because it ruins the romance, that it busts up the illusions that may be necessary for love. And I think it is very painful for people to negotiate these agreements because it means that they have to put their expectations out on the table. They have to see that there are limits to love, that a person, you know, is not willing to share all the money, that that everybody is facing up to the fact that this might not last forever. So I think it does bruise those illusions, but it's really important in many ways to do this because those illusions will go sooner or later, and I think it's better for people to have a realistic idea of what they're getting into.
Can you give us a sense of a type of prenuptial agreement that you think would work well? I know it's probably difficult to do, not having two hypothetical people with two hypothetical incomes, but still, mm-hmm. Maybe you could address that in general terms.
Well, what some lawyers say is that it's good to have an agreement that's renegotiated every few years because the situation may change.
Yeah.
So that I think that would be one important part of it. I guess another thing that would be important would be for each person to have his or her own lawyer. And some private time with that person to really be able to articulate all of their concerns, for it not to be something that's done at the last minute. Now, I think one of the problems of many of these agreements is that it's kind of foisted on one person by the other, usually by the person who has more money.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the questions that's often raised is, Well, how fair is it if a person has to agree to this if in order to get married? And it's usually the woman who has to agree. And some people feel that it's a way for men to get out of the financial obligations that, would prevail if they just divorced according to the laws of the state. But I think an answer to that is that, you don't have to marry someone who's making you agree to something that you don't like. It's a chance for you to really see what you're getting into, and you can accept the deal or reject it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Marcia Millman. She's a sociologist who's written a new book about families and money. The book is called Warm Hearts and Cold Cash. You point out in the book that children used to be seen as an economic asset. Back in the days when people farmed, you needed more children to help work the farm. And from there, children went on to be seen as economically worthless but emotionally priceless. Where are we now?
Well, I think we're certainly there. This was an argument made in a lovely book by a sociologist named Viviana Zelizer. She talked about the transformation of the child from an economically useful object to a sentimental object. In a sense, I think people have children now to have a lifelong relationship. Since they can't count on this from their spouse, the relationship with the child is seen as the enduring one.
It's become very expensive to raise children, especially if you hope to send those children through college. Do you think that the cost of raising children is affecting parent-child relationships today?
Oh, yes. I think that whenever now people are thinking about having children or how many children they'll have, they have to think of it as a financial situation, as a financial calculation. They have to think about what they're giving up financially and how it will affect their lives. So I think that is very different. It's a lot more costly to bring up children now than it used to be.
Did you find in your research that parents still see children as an investment, someone who will help take care of them in their old age, will help provide for them?
I don't think that they think their children will provide for them financially. I mean, if they do, they're crazy, because that doesn't seem to be happening very often. But I do think they think of their children as an emotional investment, that if they have children, they will never be alone, that there will always be someone who will love them. And I think that this is one of the great disappointments of many people, that they feel they've made this tremendous investment in their children, and the children often wind up, seeming quite indifferent or uncaring, or they live 3,000 miles away, or they never call home. And I think this is one of the interesting aspects of how money gets worked into the economy of love in the family, that we think of love as being given freely, but in fact, I think it rarely is given that freely, just as money isn't given that freely. That when people feel hurt, when they feel that their children have neglected them in some way or don't appreciate them in some way, I think what they often do is they bring up all the money that they spent on their children. They bring out the old canceled checks as evidence of the investment and as proof of how they've been injured.
Well, money represents the sacrifices that you've made.
Yes, it does, and it is a real sacrifice.
Did you find that there were major differences between different ethnic groups and how they dealt with money in the family?
I think there are. I was writing primarily about white middle-class people. I think that every group has different rules and understandings. For example, Carol Stack has written a book, she's an anthropologist, called All Our Kin, about poor African-American families and the idea that when you're living on the edge of survival, there's a notion that money should be shared, that just to get by, one has to be able to count on a kind of mutual aid society. I think that certainly upper-class families have a different set of rules. There's concern about not spoiling the children by giving them too much. There's also concern about not letting any generation spend all the capital and then ruin it for the next generation. I think with inherited wealth, there's a notion that the money doesn't really belong to any particular generation, that it belongs to the family for all time, and that each generation can use the interest but not the capital. And so it's considered a real crime if anyone spends the capital. So I think that every group has its own rules. And I think for the middle class, particularly the white middle class, the real rule of the family is that children are supposed to be loved equally. This is the sacred principle. And in fact, what goes on is that children are always wondering if they're loved equally. It's a kind of unrealistic notion because I think different children elicit different feelings in their parents. So everyone's kind of on the lookout for favoritism. But I think that middle-class parents are so worried about showing favoritism that they become very careful about doling out the money equally because they don't want to give any real evidence that, in fact, they preferred one child over the other. But I think this notion of loving children equally is the most sacred idea in the middle class.
Can I ask you, in all the research that you did for your new book, what was really of most value to you personally?
I think what was important to me to discover is that people suffer enormously because they feel they were cheated, that their family was not what they have a notion a family should be, and that it's really important for us to look more realistically at the limitations of love, that the fact that there is an unconditional love, that there's a lot of exchange going on in the family, that bargains are struck, and to not feel as if we're the only ones who were cheated, but that it's probably our myths of the family that are making us so unhappy about what we don't have.
Marcia Millman, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Marcia Millman is a sociologist and author of the new book, Warm Hearts and Cold Cash. It's about families and money. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.